You're listening to Unpaused, the podcast for women who want to reinvent their career after an extended break from work. Today I'm doing something completely different, interviewing Annabelle Hixon again and recording it before a live audience at Burt Home, a heritage-listed 19th century sandstone house on the outskirts of Brisbane CBD. Annabelle has been staying here for a couple of days to promote Galah magazine, which, it turns out, is not her first foray into the world of publishing and the printed word, but it's definitely her most ambitious. Annabelle's earlier best-selling book about foraging and flowers, A Tree in the House, and her voice, heard most distinctively on the iconic Dispatch to a Friend podcast, demonstrate without a shadow of doubt her eye and ear for what the market seems to hanker after at any particular moment. But for now, that's a slower read, striking photography, storytelling writ large, and the rich tapestry that makes the world of the Australian bush what it is. This is a woman who dreams in technicolor. Galah takes us deep into the diverse culture and lifestyle of Australia's regional towns, their rural surrounds and country properties, and the people who bring them to life in the most modern of ways. Who better to interpret the shifts between town and country, city and the coastline than Annabelle Hixon? She is and will always be a natural. Here she is with me in a conversation about her continuing great unpause. It's lovely to be here at the club to interview Annabelle, who's an old friend, and I did interview her a couple of years ago when she was part of a workshop in Provence, which sounds very glamorous, but actually it sort of was glamorous, I suppose, but it was also chaotic. And in the middle of it, I had my microphone in my bag and I said, oh, why don't we do an interview? So it was very impromptu. And if you listen to it on the podcast app, it's episode 11 and you'll hear the cicadas absolutely deafening, and you honestly, it's amazing. But in that interview, Annabelle was at a bit of a crossroads. She'd done a lot of things. She's a journalist. She's a writer. She's a great photographer. She's written a book on foraging for foliage and doing these amazing sculptural installations of what she finds in the bush, and she runs workshops about that. She famously has a podcast with Gillian Bell, who's here today, called Dispatch to a Friend, which was rated one of the top 10 podcasts by Apple, if not last year, the year before. Well, last year, what just didn't count for anything, really. So she's done a lot of things, but she was just at this inflection point where she wasn't sure of where to next. So she was the perfect pauser. And it's nice to be able to pick up the story with Annabelle, because she's now in the process of unpausing her career. And my sense, Annabelle, with all of those talents and that great body of work behind you, is that everything was really in plain sight. You just weren't quite ready to grasp it. Is that how you see Galah?
Yeah, I do see Galah. So if any of you who haven't seen it, Galah is a magazine that I've started about regional Australia, and I feel like all of those skills that you talked about and what Julia mentioned, they kind of all set me up to be in a position where I could start a magazine from my laptop, you know, on a pecan farm, not really near much. But yeah, so in hindsight, it seemed obvious, but I wouldn't have guessed that this is what I would do, you know, a few years ago. When we spoke, I had no idea that
no,
it would be Galah.
It was not even vaguely on the horizon, no. Was it? So what is the, what would you say is the ethos of Galah? What's it all about? And how is it different from everything else?
Well, number one, it doesn't have ads. And my beef with most magazines is that they are really just full of ads these days. But let's talk about that later. I think I grew up in Sydney, so I'm not at all a country girl, but I moved to the country about 12 years ago when I married a farmer, and I think I had all these kind of, well, do you know what, I didn't even have preconceived ideas about the country because I didn't think about it. You know, I was one of those sort of suburban city girls. I didn't think where any of the boarders who went to my school, I never imagined where they lived. I just didn't have any curiosity. And I think that sadly is actually quite a reflection on that sort of broken link between the country and the city. You know, we're such an urbanized country these days. And I think a lot of people were kind of like me. So when I did move to the country and when I discovered how delightful it was, and I really think it's been the making of me. So I think you often hear a lot about the country through a lens of disadvantage, you know, the news, the droughts, the lack of access to medical services, all of that sort of stuff. But my own personal experience has been one of tremendous advantage. So I wanted a magazine that represented that, that showed stories of all the sort of smart people I'd see everywhere I looked, all the innovation, all the creativity. And that was really the driving force of Galah. That's what I want Galah to be about primarily, to reflect all these amazing people, but also to sort of build a bit of a bridge between the city as well.
And do you see your audience as being a city audience, or is it really very much a country audience?
I can see where everyone lives who makes an order. I've got their address, which is, sounds a bit creepy, but it's about 50-50%, 50 from the country and 50 from the city, which is, I couldn't have hoped for anything more. I mean, when I'm thinking about stories, I primarily think of a country reader, but I do have in the back of my head, I want it to be interesting to someone who doesn't know anything about the country.
Annabelle, when we were preparing for this a couple of weeks ago, we were talking, and you said that you thought that a lot of the big issues that are really current in the media, things like climate change and different ways, you know, renewables, all these things, that there's an opportunity for the country to lead, that they really get that, and that's not necessarily reflected in the political leadership that they have?
Yes, well, when you think of the National Party, you don't think of leaders in climate change, you know, without a doubt. But, I mean, what Australian ag communities are really innovative because they have to be. And where are, you know, looking around, we've just put in a big solar thing. I actually do think lots of people are leading the way about this, and you know, we're ahead of the politicians in a sense, and I think it'll be, you know, I just wish there was a price on carbon, but maybe that's also a conversation for another time. But yeah, I do think.
But do you think Galah will have a role in that? Just sort of try to pick up on those new conversations that are happening.
I really want. I mean, I don't want Galah to be, you know, a left. I don't want it to have a political lean, but I really want Galah to shine a light on innovation, and there's lots of innovation, and I'm sure some of that innovation will be looking at renewables and seeing how we can make it work and seeing how we can make that profitable. You know, as soon as it's profitable, everyone will be doing it. Mm. And I do think we'll lead the way.
Annabelle, I've been through your first edition with a fine-tooth comb, and I know which is my favourite article, but tell me, which article do you think really captured the feeling that you're trying to convey with Galah?
I think that article that sort of represents this intention, it's called Why Some Towns Thrive While Others Fade Away. And we all know, driving through regional Australia, you know, you drive through some ghost towns, and it's always made me feel really sad. And I wanted to know why that happens, why a little town like Nundle, just near Tamworth, can be thriving, and why another little town can be empty. So there's a big piece in Galah that's about that. And it was really interesting. It was based on a professor, a Brisbane-based professor, and he did a study a while ago, but we spoke to him recently, and the findings are still really applicable. He says it's really counterintuitive in all these, looking at these small towns that are thriving, it's the number of leaders. No, let me get this right. Leaders don't necessarily mean leadership. And these towns that are thriving don't really have so many leaders. They have lots of people who feel like they have some kind of contribution they can make. Like, for example, in Nundle, it's a town of about 300 people. It has, I think it was 26 different community groups that you could be part of. You know, there's lots of avenues for people to make a contribution. And so, you know, he was sort of saying, like, maybe mayors that have been in place for a very long time, and you know, people who describe themselves as leaders are actually, that's not necessarily a good sign. And he also said something really interesting, was that you've got to welcome the weirdos. That was his quote. And by weirdos, he means artists. And that they are a really good proxy for a community's willingness to embrace innovation. So in Galar, there's actually quite a lot of stories about artists, and I really mean that intentionally, and I hope to continue that, because we need to support the artists because they actually bring so much to our communities. So that was the piece is really, I think it's a, you know, it was written by a journalist based in Brisbane, Roseanne Barrett, and she does some stuff for The Australian. We used to work together at The Australian. Well, she was around at the same time as I was. So that's, yeah, I'd recommend reading it, and I'd love to know what you think.
And what about Tenterfield? Because Tenterfield's a bit of a, it's got quite a good vibe now, hasn't it?
It has a great vibe. So I live west of Tenterfield, and it's got quite, it's got an older demographic than the national average. It's, well, lovely Sarah Caldwell, she's here. We Tenterfield is both of our towns, and you've been there for much longer than I have, so I'd love to know what you think. But certainly from what I see, there are lots more people coming over from Brisbane. There's little Airbnbs popping up. We don't quite have a nice restaurant yet. Oh, that's not true. We've got the German place. So it seems to be a town that is thriving, and there are a real mix of people. It's not all ag there, and I think that's key too. You know, as farms become more and more efficient, which is great and something we're proud of, they employ less and less people, which just, you know, they don't, I think, I'm not sure if farming quite has the same maybe power in a community as it did from what I'm such a newcomer, so if I say anything you don't agree with, just put that down to my ignorance. But I think it's great because we can have lots of different industries and different people bringing different things to a community, and we want diversity in communities. I do. They're the sort of communities I want to live in.
Now, Belle, what about this idea of creating a physical magazine at a time when everything's gone digital? Doesn't it seem sort of like you're running against the pack there? What is it about a magazine in 2021 that feels so right to you?
Well, it is running against the pack, because when I started, the Sydney Morning Herald called to do a story just about someone starting a printed magazine. Like, that was news. So I thought, oh my goodness, I'm mad. But I love reading. I know lots of people who love reading. I am so overwhelmed with pins and charging things, and it fries my head after a while. I love holding a book, and I just really felt like there was a place still for something written. And to me, written things are the best way to consume a story. So I just thought there's definitely space for it. And it's, I guess I just took a gamble, and I hoped I wasn't alone. And certainly from the response, well, I am not alone. People want to read things they can hold, which is, you know, really lovely. And I think they can have more time. You know, on Instagram and reading even the news online, it's there for a few seconds and then it's gone into the great abyss. I do like the sort of more permanent feature, and the fact that everybody is reading the same thing. Like in this sort of algorithm world where the news is sort of selected depending on what you're into, we don't really have one common, you know, it's also, you can go into your own little echo chambers very easily. And I do like the idea of having something fixed that everybody can have their own experience with, but it's that same thing.
Mm. What about its beauty?
I think beauty is a hugely motivating force. I think beauty lures people in, so I've definitely invested in really great photography. I think we mustn't ever underestimate the power of beauty. And you know, quite a few of the stories and even in issue two going forward, they're a bit more on the sort of lifestyle-y side. You know, I want to have some newsy features, but there's a lot of lifestyle. I love reading about beautiful things, and I feel like that can kind of soften the path to get into just maybe a bit more of a juicy, meaty topic without feeling overwhelmed. So I think I think beauty's really important.
Annabelle, what about the issue of advertising? I mean, it's not an inexpensive magazine.
Yes.
But you have no ads to offset the cost. Is that really sustainable? I mean, what's your philosophy and how does it work?
Yeah, so I've gone for more of a book model, I suppose. So the cover price is $30, which is a lot more than what we're used to paying for a magazine. But like I said right at the beginning, I am sick of buying something for $10 and flicking through ad, and then I feel like a schmuck, really, under that model. And I think that unless...
So why do you feel like that?
Because I chose to pay money for something to be advertised at. I feel like the product. Mm. You know what I mean? And I think if you don't pay for something well, you are the product. You know, like on Instagram, it's free. You don't pay for it, but they advertise at you. They use your data. You are the product. So I don't get that feeling when I'm reading a book. You know, I pay for it and I get to read it. So I thought, well, let me try this with a mag. So there are no ads in it. A few people have said, where are the ads? I miss the ads. I want to know what to buy. So, you know, some people love, you know, and they can be quite useful in terms of, oh, I didn't know about that brand and isn't that dress lovely? Or, you know, it can be useful. So I'm not completely opposed to it. But if I'm going, you know, we have so much advertising thrown at us and less people are reading printed material. So if they're going to pick up Galah, why would I then just advertise at them? I just feel like that's not right. And advertising digitally is great. It's so transparent. You can see how many, you know, it's good for the advertiser. And I don't know, I just feel like as Galah expands and maybe goes into more of a digital space, that's where advertising could work really well. But I'm going to try and keep the actual magazine ad-free. I mean, I'd love any feedback on that, whether you think that's a good idea or not. But certainly with a cover price of $30, it can be a great little business, you know, once I get up to a certain...
You'll have a very valuable data set, Annabelle.
Yes.
Seems like a shame not to be able to use that somehow.
It's all about trust, though, don't you think? As soon as you start abusing your data set, then why... Why would any? I don't know.
I'm full of admiration that you've sort of taken this position and held to the line. And it'll be interesting to see if you can sustain it.
It will be. And yeah, I could have to eat my words. But you know what made it so much less risky is that I was able to do pre-orders. Is everyone familiar with pre-orders? You know, I said the Galah's going to exist. Place your pre-order now. This is all through Instagram, which is such a powerful tool, especially living away from big networks of people. I was able to do this all from my little laptop, you know, in my bedroom. And there were enough pre-orders that could pay for the printing and could pay for some of those initial setup fees. So, you know, it actually wasn't a huge risk. By the time I pressed print, I knew it was not going to be an unmitigated disaster. And certainly the reaction after it came out has been even more positive.
Can you just talk about, just because I'm interested, talk about Instagram as a sort of a tool for unpausing. Like you are the consummate Instagram queen. Annabelle has, I checked it yesterday, she has 71,500 followers, which is embarrassing for me. But like how do you make that work without being sort of seduced by it? How do you do it in a way that still maintains your sort of, your integrity, you know, your sort of personal integrity? And because you have done that. You're still pure Annabelle on Instagram.
Yeah, well, that's it. Like at one end of the spectrum is the Kardashians, I suppose, who have given everything. Everything seems to be public and they've done very well out of it, you know, financially. But I look at that and especially as a mother, and I think, wow, I can't imagine using my children in that very public way. So they're sort of at one end of the spectrum. The other end would be doing nothing publicly. And if I'd done that, I wouldn't have had this network to give me the confidence to start, you know, to self-publish a magazine. So, yeah, how much to give and how much to keep? I mean, I really try to not involve my kids. Occasionally they kind of appear, but I don't. When they were younger, I probably did use them a bit more. But now that they're a bit older, I'm sort of really conscious that they're their own people. And in the flower book, there was a picture of them in there, and they were quite little. And Daisy, my oldest, she was just in her undies, you know, playing with some flowers, which at the time was, you know, completely gorgeous. But now she's a bit older, and she looks back and she said, "Mum, I'm so embarrassed. I'm so embarrassed." You know, so it's funny. I mean, not that any of her friends would read A Tree in the House, I'm sure of that. But it is interesting, and I think you do have to be really, really careful. But, I mean, I definitely use Instagram as a business tool. So I'm not on Instagram talking about how sad I feel about something personal. You know, it's a business tool. I use it as a, you know, beauty. I think it's amazing because you can take really beautiful photos, and it works so well with Instagram. So I just think... Yeah, I use it in a very conscious way of what I'm happy to be public. Maybe sometimes I don't get it all right, but it doesn't seem that complicated.
No, but I think that what I've observed of you is that you've used it as a way to connect with other women in particular all around the world who aren't fancy, they aren't professionals, but they have, you know, they're great photographers, they're great cooks, they're outdoors people, and it has given you an amazing network of peers and like-minded sort of talented amateurs. I mean, you've just suddenly professionalised, Annabelle, but it has been a great way to sort of broaden your reach.
Really, I have a great friend who lives in France. Gillian, who we do the podcast with, we met through Instagram. You know, I cannot tell you how many real life incredible people have come into my life because of it. So, you know, I think it's obviously there's a lot that we can criticise social media for, but I mean, I wasn't a teenager when it was around. You know, only it came into it as an adult. So
maybe
it's...
I don't think any of us were either. No.
But I think
it's been good for you. It's been good for the business.
It's been incredible, and it means I can create this sort of career and live where I do. And I love living where I do. You know, I really feel very, very lucky.
Mm. Annabelle, what about the process of... How do you go from being in Provence and thinking, I have no idea what to do next, and then suddenly, 18 months later, produce a magazine, fully formed, absolutely beautiful? I mean, what do you actually do to go from a complete standstill to this? Like, not in granular detail, but what was the really big thing you did that you really felt took you from A to B?
Well, it was an idea that had been bubbling away, but, you know, ideas are easy. It's making them happen that is the tricky bit, I think. And I think what really pushed me over the edge was... So I used to work for Country Style, which is such a, you know, well-loved magazine, and I've seen how it's really created such a... You know, the readers of Country Style are loyal. It's amazing. So I worked for them, and then they, when all that media kerfuffle happened and News Limited sold them to Bauer, and then Bauer sold it off at, you know, a fraction of what it had been bought for not that long ago, I really thought that I couldn't imagine a bright future for that anymore, just because budgets were completely slashed, and I didn't know how they'd be able to continue. They are, so this isn't at all a criticism of Country Style, but it was that moment I thought, now's the time where I can give something a go as an independent that's not owned by some sort of investment bank that's just trying to extract value. And that was the sort of catalyst. And then as to how it sort of just came from an idea to that, again, I feel like I'm being paid by Instagram, but through Instagram I'd made all these kind of contacts, so I thought, I'd love, you know, so-and-so to write a story. So I kind of had, and I could message them, directly.
But did you have this vast sort of storyboard, and you moved pieces of paper on the storyboard? And
well, at the end, so I just had this, it was like a crazy sort of Word document. Then I took over my husband's whiteboard, like rubbed off all these little, you know...
Important things.
Paddock whatevers, and then I moved to Post-it notes. I don't know what I'm doing. It's all really new, but, you know, it's not rocket science. Like, surely. Having said that, I think the monthly or those beautiful weekend newspaper magazines, you know, they are phenomenal. That's where I'm hoping to end up. you know, and I am just starting now. And it just, I honestly don't know. It was, I was upset. I would wake up at 3 o'clock in the morning and I mean, it was like there was this fire within. And for 6 months I neglected my children. Ed was just sort of supportive and kind of frightened, I think. I just made it happen. And my goodness, the work involved, I love writing. So I, as an editor, I don't want that to stop me being able to write a bit myself. You know, that's my favourite thing. But gosh, it is a lot of organisation, you know, coordinating different people and photography. And I really underestimated how much time that involves.
I heard you say that it was 10% inspiration and 90% slog.
Yeah, maybe even 95.
Yeah.
I think. But it's, you know, I'm up for hard work. I love working. I find working way easier than being a mother. To my shame, like I find actually the theme for the second issue is the domestic, mainly because I find it so hard.
Well, I loved in the, I could really recommend Annabelle's podcast with Gillian, Dispatch to a Friend. It's really charming. And in the most recent episode, towards the end, Annabelle says, I feel like I've been such a bad mother, Gillian. Can you give me a recipe for that apricot thingy? And then if I made that, you know, maybe things would be better.
Yeah. That's right.
And I think that's, you know, you do that, don't you? You think, oh, right, I've got to pull myself together and do something domesticated.
But don't you think this balance, this sort of myth of the balanced woman where you work and you're a mother and you keep your house clean, I mean, if any of you come to the valley on this excursion, I mean, if you came now, you would never speak to me again. My house is it's chaos. It's chaos. But there is, I can't find a balance. I feel like there's that American writer David Sedaris, who very wisely, I think, talks about life as being four gas burners. One burner is family, one is friends, one is work, and one is health. And he said, if you want to do well in any of those, you've got to turn off a gas burner. And if you want to do really well, you turn off two. And, I mean, that seems to be how it is with me. Like, right now, the work gas burner is high and my poor kids, well, they're all right. They're fine, you know, they're fine. Daisy's getting very good at organising her own play dates and other mothers to bring her things. So that's a skill too. but, you know, this, I don't know. This is my work burner's up. Hi.
But you have. There is this idea, though, that perhaps people in the bush have got a better balance intra couples, just because it's sort of a partnership.
That's certainly what I see when I look around. I see strong partnerships between the male and the female, and I wonder if that comes down to actually just spending so much time together. You know, especially if, you know, like I think people in the country as couples do spend a lot more time than in this. I grew up, my dad, you know, worked in an office. They lived actually quite separate lives. But, I mean, I see Ed all the time. Morning tea, lunch, you know. But I think that does make for a stronger partnership because you have so much shared common ground. And, I mean, he's actually amazing with the kids too, you know, that these modern men these days, that it's he's taking them to a swimming carnival today, you know. And what was your question? I feel like now I'm rambling.
The question was, how do you make that work? Like, why does it work better in the country? I mean, you obviously spend more time together, but is there anything else? Are you more sort of specific about who does what?
Well, I do think well-articulated roles are really crucial. I mean, now those roles are a bit, you know, perhaps 50 years ago they were much more, you know, women did things and men did things. And in a way that's easy because the roles were, you knew what was sort of expected. I think now it's kind of a brave new world where we can come up with our own sets of rules. But I definitely think, and I, you know, this is only just from what I see, that perhaps it is a little more traditional in the country. But we sort of know, you know I cook dinner and Ed takes out the rubbish. And I don't know,
That happens at home too.
Does that happen at home? Okay, maybe.
Well, the rubbish seems to be the last frontier, but yeah. I don't know. Today's rubbish day, isn't it? Or maybe not. Just coming back to that whole idea of the, from my perspective, you know, the country woman is the domestic goddess. of Australia.
Yes.
And they're so competent.
Yes.
And I suppose the CWA sort of captures that spirit and that sense of competence. But it's not just, you know, the kitchen. It's their community competent.
Oh.
The community is very intact.
Yeah.
Whereas in the city, you know, it's so fragmented. And is that something that Galar touches on? Well, you started to say that the next issue is domestic?
Yeah, the domestic. Yeah.
So what is that going to look like?
Well, lots of different things. I mean, and lots of even sort of points of views that aren't necessarily to do with women. But I want to go back to women being... I've learnt so much about domestic life through watching women around me in the country, and they seem to do it in quite a feminist way. You know, like Julia will have 20 people over for dinner, be having a blast herself. Somehow we get, you know, just not in a meek and mild, you know, servant in the kitchen way. And there's the competence of, and I think that comes down to practice. You know, there aren't restaurants to go out to. When you have people over, they come to your house. When you have business meetings, they come to your house. You know, the bank manager, you pour the tea for, like, it's all in your domestic sphere, which is alarming for me because it's chaotic in my domestic sphere. But certainly looking around, it's I've learned a lot. And even me, chaos domestic woman, I have become more competent just through sheer practice. And that sort of sense of generosity, I think it's so beautiful. I think I have friends in the city, I mean, not Julian, she's an amazing cook, but friends who are almost scared of having people over to their house, you know, and that, I feel like that does not, you can't have that feeling. You just have to break through it in the country because what else are you going to do?
Mm.
Yeah, it's really, I've learned a lot.
So in the domestic sphere, though, for a magazine, how do you capture that?
Yeah, well, all different ways. I mean, to me, the domestic is... anything to do with your home and just anything to do with your private life and how you can kind of compose that. I think that's what I'm interested. Like I said, in, you know, it's this brave new world. We don't have to just be women at home looking after kids. We can sort of create our own, what our own domestic life looks like these days. So there'll be all sorts of different stories from men and women. There's a story about a woman who actually grew up on a farm somewhere out of Brewarrina, in a fundamentalist Christian family. So her domestic world was actually quite hard and sad, and she couldn't wait to get out of there. So it's not all, you know, baking muffins and wearing aprons. You know, I think I love the light and the shadow. And I think in mag world, we can often, it can just be about the light, which can just feel a bit superficial. And we're all full of light and shadow. So I kind of want both. I want to capture both.
Well, I'm glad. Because that's beautiful, Annabelle, and I think you're very good at that. And I think that there's it's a sort of a bit of an unspoken subject, isn't it? You know, that it's just taken for granted that it'll be taken care of, but no one's ever really nodded to it as a bit of a really big cultural element that underpins a social life, a domestic social life, a family life, a community life, a caring life, you know?
Mm. Yeah.
Nice subject. Although I do like a good apron, Annabelle.
Yeah, well, me too. Me too.
So my final question is Galar just for women?
Well, it's only women who buy it, really. There's the occasional man, and I do a little dance when I see a man's name come in just because it's so novel. But I have, interestingly, had feedback from quite a few men saying how much they've enjoyed it, or at least parts of it. And to me, that's really important because we are a community of men and women. You know, we are, and I think interesting things are interesting to anyone. And I certainly, that's my intention. I want everything in Galar to be interesting. So yeah, I'd love men to be readers, but it's the beautiful women that make the decision to buy it.
And at a sort of a practical level, how often does it come out? Where do you buy it?
Yes.
How do you sort of?
So I started off saying it was a quarterly, and then when I realised how much work it was, I started saying seasonally. Ed says there are four seasons in a year. Like, it's the same thing. And it's like, well, maybe a wet and a dry season. I don't know. Three times a year. So it's not every month. I think that timetable is really grueling, and I'm not sure how you could come up, I mean, unless you had a really big team, how you could come up with, you know, good content that often. So I'm going for the 3 times a year. And then, I mean, you can, thanks to the power of the internet, and you can build your own website so easily, and I'm not a techie person, you can buy it online through me direct. But also, too, we're forming a little network of shops. I would be really interested to know, actually, in the chat afterwards, how many of you still go to news agencies? We are selling it in some news agencies, but we're focusing on building up a network of shops, you know, lovely shops where you'd buy sort of homeware. You know, I feel like that's the kind of where it should be, and regional and some city-based ones. So it's great. And then it's an excuse to also meet all these amazing shopkeepers. And
I think Annabelle's got some magazines outside, share.
Yes, we do. And thank you, everyone, for coming and being interested in Galah. And thank you to the club for having me. It's been beautiful. I stayed here last night and I just feel like some kind of princess. It's just beautiful. So thanks, everyone.
Thanks to everyone concerned for bringing this live interview to life. Producer Leonie Marsh, sound recording Jason Milhouse, The Morton Club and the redoubtable Annabelle Hickson herself. Don't forget Annabelle's early story features in episode 11 of Unpaused. I listened to it again the other day and it's lovely. I was transported right back to that hot summer's day in rural Provence. If you like the episode and want to tell me what you think, drop me a line. You can always reach me on email at judith@unpaused.net. And if you know someone you think would like this episode too, send them a link. It's easiest to do from the podcast app. Just click share. I do it with podcasts all the time. That's it for today. Until next time, farewell.